Civilians, including children, are killed in a Ukrainian city far from the front lines of the war by a submarine-fired Russian missile.
Cruise missiles hit two community facilities, houses, and a medical center were destroyed. Cars and trams were set on fire.
Plus, a possible deal involving Kiev and Moscow to allow Black Sea exports of Ukrainian grain.
I'm encouraged. I'm optimistic. But it's not yet fully done.
And later in the program, crowdfunding drones for Ukraine. Today is Thursday, July 14th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Herman. At least 22 civilians have died, including three children, and dozens more people wounded in the latest Russian missile strike in Ukraine. Ukrainian officials say the central city of Vinnytsia, far from the front lines, was hit by Caliber-type cruise missiles fired from a Russian submarine in the Black Sea. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, speaking remotely to an international conference focused on prosecuting war crimes committed by the Russians, called the attack an act of Russian terror.
This morning, Russian missiles hit our city of Vinnytsia, an ordinary, peaceful city. Cruise missiles hit two community facilities, houses, and a medical center were destroyed. Cars and trams were set on fire.
Following that conference at which Zelensky made the comment, the Dutch foreign minister said Western countries need to consider establishing a special tribunal to try war crimes committed in Ukraine to prevent them from going unpunished. Wopke Hoekstra said a vacuum needs to be filled as the International Criminal Court does not have jurisdiction. He acknowledged that setting up such a special tribunal probably will not be easy, but the idea should be pursued. Ukraine's top prosecutor, Irina Venediktova, says Kyiv has already started prosecutions of 127 war crimes suspects. Russia has denied targeting civilians. 45 countries at that conference in The Hague, which is the headquarters of the International Criminal Court, signed a political declaration to work together on investigations into war crimes in Ukraine. At a news conference in Jerusalem on Thursday, U.S. President Joe Biden said Israel and the United States stand together to defend fundamental values and underwrite global security, prosperity, and freedom.
And Putin's assault on Ukraine is a challenge to the peace and stability everywhere in the world. Putin's war must be a strategic failure, and the free world must sustain our resolve to help Ukraine defend its democracy. The United States will continue to support Ukraine and the Ukrainian people who have been devastated and displaced by the Russian violence.
A report by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe is expressing grave concerns about alleged mistreatment by Russia of tens of thousands of Ukrainians forcibly deported from their country and sent to so-called filtration centers. Agence France-Presse, quoting from the 115-page document, says there are reports indicating that people are subject to harsh interrogations and humiliating body searches in such centers. It adds, those found to have collaborated with Ukrainian authorities often simply disappear, with some allegedly being transferred to Russian-controlled territories where they are detained or killed. The OSCE report says that signs of torture and ill treatment on the corpses of killed civilians also show disregard of the principle of humanity. The report is based on information obtained by three experts named by the OSCE, covering the Ukraine war from the beginning of April through late June. The Russian embassy in Washington, in a statement, calls the OSCE report an attempt to stoke Russophobia and poor-quality Western disinformation. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, says an important and substantive step has been made regarding resumption of Black Sea exports of grain from Ukraine. The breakthrough comes following talks among Russia, Ukraine, Turkey, and UN officials in Istanbul.
in a world darkened by global crisis, today at last we have a ray of hope. A ray of hope to ease human suffering and alleviate hunger around the world. A ray of hope to support developing countries and the most vulnerable people. A ray of hope to bring a measure of much-needed stability to the global food system. Since the war started, I have been underlining the importance of having Ukraine's food products and Russian food and fertilizers fully available in world markets. I traveled to Moscow and Kyiv to propose solutions for both problems. Every day since, we have been working around the clock with intense behind-the-scenes talks with countless moving parts.
Guterres, speaking to reporters in New York on Wednesday, acknowledged more technical work needs to be done to turn the negotiating process into actual movement of grain.
We are hoping that we'll be able to reconvene very soon. I'm sure next week, and hopefully we'll be able to have a final agreement. But, as I said, we still need a lot of goodwill and commitment by all parties. They have shown it. I'm encouraged. I'm optimistic. But it's not yet fully done.
Although Ukraine and Russia engaged with each other to discuss the grain exports, Guterres added that, for peace, we still have a long way to go. Turkish Defense Minister Hulusi Akar says the deal will be signed when the parties meet again, and it includes joint controls for checking grain imports and Turkey ensuring the safety of Black Sea export routes for Ukrainian grain. More from Dorian Jones in Istanbul.
Turkish Defense Minister Hulusi Akar said in a statement after Wednesday's talks that a deal to allow the release of millions of tons of Ukrainian grain could come as early as next week. Akar said Turkey would play a pivotal role in checking shipments in harbours and guaranteeing the safety of Black Sea export routes. In addition, a coordination centre with Ukraine, Russia and the United Nations for exporting grain would be set up in Turkey, he said. Trust has been a key stumbling block in months of diplomatic efforts to reach a deal. Kyiv has said it fears that if it demines its ports to allow cargo ships to export grain, Russian forces will use that move to their advantage and attack. The grain has been stuck amid Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Aaron Stein of the Philadelphia-based Foreign Policy Research Institute says trust and international sanctions on Russia have been the main obstacles.
This food corridor would require the Ukrainians to remove mines from seaports. They were put there for a reason, to keep Russians from invading their country. And there is no appetite whatsoever to lift sanctions, because that is the Russian demand. And that's just not going to happen.
The Reuters news agency quotes a UN official speaking anonymously as saying that most of the sticking points have been overcome, without giving details. Moscow has so far not commented on the Istanbul talks. Meanwhile, the UN warns that unless tens of millions of tons of grain stuck in Ukrainian ports are released, world food prices will continue to climb, threatening famine across the globe. Ukraine is a leading wheat exporter, and nations in Africa are heavily dependent on Ukrainian grain. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine is determined to reach a deal. Zelensky said his government is putting significant effort into resuming the supply of food to the world market. He said he is grateful to the United Nations and Turkey for their efforts. The progress at the Istanbul talks has underlined Turkey's position as a critical facilitator in negotiations between the warring parties, says Sinan Ülgen of the Center for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies, a research organization in Istanbul.
President Erdogan has been careful to highlight that Turkey wants to maintain relations with both sides. So as a result of this, you know, balanced policy, Turkey is also trying to carve out a space for diplomatic influence as a facilitator or potentially as a mediator.
President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has close ties with his Ukrainian and Russian counterparts. Ahead of the Istanbul talks, the Turkish leader spoke with Zelensky. Next week, the Turkish leader is scheduled to meet face-to-face with President Vladimir Putin in Tehran for talks that could be key to finalizing any deal to get Ukrainian grain back on world markets. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Herman. Russia is limiting exports of noble gases such as neon, a key ingredient in the manufacturing process for computer chips, until the end of the year. Exports of noble gases, which Russia supplies to Japan and other nations, will only be allowed with special state permission until December 31st, according to officials in Moscow. They say this is to rearrange broken supply chains. Ukraine, another leading supplier of noble gases, had to suspend production at its plants in Mariupol and Odessa back in March. We're joined now on Flashpoint Ukraine by Jonas Sundquist, senior technology analyst of TechSet, an advisory services firm focused on process material supply chains and electronic materials technology. Jonas, you seem like the perfect person to ask this. How big of a problem is it that Russia and Ukraine are out of the supply chain right now for neon and other noble gases?
Yes, it's a big problem. We can see that on prices are going up on critical gases that are used in the semiconductor industry. And these gases that are affected by the Russian invasion of Ukraine is gases like helium, neon, krypton, and xenon. And these are all four very important gases in the semiconductor industry.
I'm going to attempt a simple explanation here, that neon is used to control the wavelength of light produced by a laser for etching the patterns onto the silicon wafers that make up these chips that are in everything from our cell phones to our cars these days. Are there alternatives to neon?
No, there are no alternatives to neon. So neon is a critical gas. So without neon, you can't design the chips you want. So it's part of this patterning process where the design companies like Apple, Qualcomm, and other companies, they design their chips and they made them at the foundries, or you have Intel chips that are designed by Intel and made by Intel, and they all rely on neon.
The Ukrainians, as we've seen since the Russian invasion, are resourceful and able to improvise. How difficult, Jonas, would it be for them to set up new facilities in other parts of Ukraine or in different countries?
Yeah, so these are major investments that has been made over decades. It's the investment itself and also the know-how how to purify these gases. That is a requirement for the semiconductor industry. Basically, you would have to build up new facilities elsewhere. And what we indirectly can see is that since this crisis has been going on since 2014, right, for the first invasion of Ukraine, there has been capacity increase investments in China. China has reacted on this and has become a bigger supplier of some of these critical gases that basically are purified out of the thin air in huge facilities.
We have some government officials and lawmakers in the United States and other countries calling this a national security issue. But there is some production here in the United States, right?
Yes, indeed. So for neon specifically, the U.S. production is somewhere, 10 to 15% of the total market. But the U.S. semiconductor industry is much bigger than 10 to 15%. So the U.S. relies on import of neon. Where it is better situation right now is helium, where U.S. has traditionally been a big supplier of helium. But for helium, the world has relied on planned expansions taking place in Russia with Gazprom, and these are all delayed. Those expansions, it's written in the sky if they will ever happen. That's another angle on this, is that helium can become critical, and helium is also important to other industries than just the semiconductor industry. So it's important cooling refrigerant, it's important for medical applications and so on, including party balloons,
So it's even an issue if you're planning a party, apparently. Jonas Sundquist, Senior Technology Analyst of TechSet, thank you for your insight today on VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
A lawsuit has been filed in Canada seeking to halt the return of a Russian gas turbine for the Nord Stream 1 pipeline that supplies natural gas to Europe. The legal action has been filed by the Ukrainian World Congress and Daniel Bielak, a Canadian lawyer living in Ukraine.
The Germans need the gas now to fill their reservoirs. That's my understanding. And there are other ways of doing this. Look, I feel sorry for the German people. I mean, they are suffering from abject reality of failed German policy towards Russia over the past 10 years, both by Chancellor Schrader and Chancellor Merkel. But frankly, you know, I'm worried about my own head and the heads of Ukrainians. And every penny, every cent that goes to Gazprom to pay for gas being pumped into Germany is going to rain death and rockets down on my head and those of the people that I serve with. I'm a member of the Territorial Defense Forces here.
Bielak, speaking from Kiev on Wednesday during an online discussion about the situation in Ukraine organized by the New York City-based Overseas Press Club. Canadian sanctions prevented the Siemens company from returning the turbine to Russia, and Nord Stream's owners say they cannot operate the pipeline at full capacity without the turbine. Canada's government earlier this week announced it would issue a time-limited revocable permit to allow the turbine to be returned to Russia despite the sanctions. At the same Overseas Press Club event, Andriy Usadchuk, a member of the Ukrainian parliament from the Golos Party, said any ceasefire proposals in the war between Ukraine and Russia are unacceptable to the Ukrainian side, but likely not to the Russians.
They would be happy to have a break, but with keeping territories which they temporarily occupy. For us, it's absolutely unacceptable. As from tactical point of view, I mean, from the military point of view, as definitely from political point of view, because we understand well that this salami approach is one of the favorite tactics of Russians. So to slide territories piece by piece. And if we froze the conflict, there is zero doubts that the Russians will come back again and we will lose again the parts of Ukraine. So that's why I think we went so far in this war now, that now this war cannot be stopped.
Osadchuk added, after Ukraine is able to liberate the territories inside the country seized by the Russians, then Kyiv will be open to negotiations. Ukraine has been asking for additional weapons and other military supplies from the United States and other countries. What it probably did not expect was citizens of other countries willing to help fund purchases. Lithuania's government last week transferred to Ukraine a Turkish-made Bayraktar TB2 combat drone, which was originally paid for by Lithuanian citizens via crowdfunding. Lithuanians raised almost 6 million euros, about 6 million U.S. dollars, largely in small donations, following which the Turkish manufacturer of the drone decided to donate it instead. The Baykar company and Lithuania agreed that 1.5 million euros would be spent to arm the drone, with the rest of the crowdfunded money going for humanitarian aid in Ukraine. The idea appears to be spreading. Now, a Polish journalist and sociologist has started a crowdfunding campaign to buy the same type of drone for Ukraine's military. Sławomir Sierakowski joins us now from Warsaw on Flashpoint Ukraine. Welcome, Sławomir.
Hey, hello, everybody. Before me, Lithuanians did the same, and this was also organized or hosted by one of the journalists, actually TV host. But there, actually, government was involved, prime minister, minister of defense. Here it's totally spontaneous. It's a grassroots. It's just my crazy individual idea. I didn't even know how much we need. Couldn't make it really active. I did not add picture. This was like I would be illiterate. But the regular people made a decision that we need it, because when I clicked it next day, I had 1 million zloty, which is a lot. 120,000 people involved, And it's a very engaged group. People are paying a few times. Still, it's a very grassroots, but the media joined us. I have no concerns as for whether journalists should do it or not. I mean, as long as Russians don't care to whom they shoot, and they shoot to journalists exactly the same way they shoot to regular citizens. So I think that everybody knows that, you know, with humanitarian aid, you cannot win the war. You have to have weapon. And this is what we're doing.
How has your government reacted as relations between many journalists and officials have been adversarial there recently?
Here in Poland, there is a strong political conflict. I'm a liberal journalist and the government is populist, let's say. I'm one of the most hated journalists by the government. But I'm trying to make this action totally neutral concerning politics. And I invited people from the right side, everybody.
Have you experienced any public backlash there? Because essentially you're raising money among civilians for what essentially is a lethal weapon.
It's the first this kind of action in Poland since 1939. So the situation is exceptional, extraordinary. And of course, it would be much better to have the government on my side. I will invite them. I want them to be a part of it. I have no problem with this. But of course, I don't know how the government will react. We are thinking about Ukraine and Ukrainian interest. We don't care that much about other things. So there is no big backlash. I wouldn't say that there is any like conflict about it. People are pretty much clear. We need to support Ukraine. Ukraine needs weapon. We organize weapon for them.
And what has been the reaction from Ukraine to your campaign to buy them a drone for the war against Russia?
From the first day, we had huge resonance in Ukraine. As for media, all possible media platforms reacted. Then I realized that it's not about drone only, that it's about hope. It's about the fear that people abroad are forgetting this war. You know, are like, you know, the attention is not anymore so much attracted as before. It's a fifth month, and when you have, you know, vacation and huge inflation in Europe. And then surprisingly, Poles decide to organize themselves and buy weapons for Ukraine. So for them, this was very important symbolically. This is why the parliament reacted. Ministry of Defense reacted. Ukrainian embassy in Poland is closely following it. I know that for Ukrainians, this is important.
That's Polish journalist Sławomir Sierakowski, whose campaign as of Thursday has raised the equivalent of about $2.8 million. That laser-guided bomb-dropping Turkish drone that the Lithuanian and Polish citizens have funded for Ukraine has proven to be less effective recently, as the Russians have improved their air and electronic defenses in eastern Ukraine. But overall, drones are playing a big role as Ukraine defends itself against the Russian invaders. Yuri Shichol, head of Ukraine's Service of Special Communications and Information Protection, says the military has an insatiable appetite for the unmanned aerial vehicles.
The biggest problem for small drones is electronic warfare systems, so we require thousands of them. They do get shot down. They fly at high altitudes and fall all the time, so we need thousands of them to support our army.
The official says Ukraine has started a new fundraising campaign called the Army of Drones to initially purchase 200 NATO-grade military drones, but he says 10 times that number are really required. That's all for today's program. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on our social media platforms, just follow VOA News. On behalf of all members of the Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA Chief National Correspondent Steve Herman. Have a good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.